It's Sunday, December 10th, 2006. This is James Robertson with Syncom Systems, welcoming you to episode 13 of Industry Misinterpretations. This week, David, Michael, and I discussed the Object Studio 8 project briefly, and then that led into a conversation of embedding one language into another language, specifically trying to model languages inside Smalltalk. That eventually rambled its way on to a general discussion of industry trends, including Microsoft Windows and other platforms. So we carried on quite a while, but it should be an interesting conversation. I hope you enjoy it.
Hey, darling, I gotta talk to you about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be explained to you.
So I know, Michael, you at least had time to listen to that podcast, right?
Yeah, I did.
And I guess, Dave, you probably didn't have time to listen to it.
I listened to about half of it so far.
That means you listened to the part with probably better audio quality anyway. Yeah, if I didn't understand why sound engineers get paid the big bucks, I do now.
Yeah, it's not a trivial task.
No. And we had second or maybe even third-rate equipment to kind of do this. We were hooking up remote microphones just into a line-in jack on a ThinkPad. Not even probably as high-tech as what I'm doing now with Skype. I guess what I wanted to talk about maybe was kind of thing that we did with Object Studio, where what we have is Object Studio being modeled on top of VisualWorks. And that raises the question of what other kinds of things you could easily model in Smalltalk. I guess if you go back far enough, Dave, you probably even remember this. Way back in the old days of Smalltalk V, I think it shipped with, if I recall, there was a Lisp interpreter that shipped with one of the early versions, wasn't there?
I remember something about a Lisp interpreter way
maybe
back.
Maybe it was fourth.
I've seen a Prolog interpreter.
Oh, that's the one I'm thinking of.
In Smalltalk, yes.
There's a Prolog interpreter and a Lisp interpreter in June.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
So that's been there for a while then. That thing's so big that it's got gosh knows what in it.
Yeah, it's got tentacles and hair growing from all different sides.
As it turns out, actually, the very first version of Visual Age for Java was written in Smalltalk.
Oh, in Visual Age for C++?
Actually, the whole Visual Age line was written in Smalltalk originally. That was before they had Eclipse as the universal IDE for everything. They had Visual Age as the universal IDE for everything.
Now, I know you're kind of sort of suggesting that sort of model for VisualWorks, aren't you, James?
Well, I don't know if I'd suggest it as a model. I'm kind of curious about what you think is the possibility of doing that beyond what we've done already with Object Studio.
You'd find general consensus that the whole Visual Age line with all these different versions of Visual Age for different languages was pretty much a bad idea.
Okay, so why don't you go ahead and explain that?
Well, simply put, the one reason why the environment was so good in Smalltalk was because it was written in Smalltalk. When you went and did that for Java and C++, etc., it was written in Smalltalk still, so for the developers using C++ or Java, etc., they weren't getting the real advantages that we got in the Visual Age Smalltalk version.
Meaning they didn't have the ability to drop down and change the environment, or...?
Yeah, I mean, that's one part of it, but it's also the other part of it is that all those libraries that went into making the environment were available to the Smalltalk users because they were written in Smalltalk and you could just use them, so the GUI builder, the widget libraries, the network libraries, all of these things were there. So when you got Visual Age for Java and Visual Age for C++, those things weren't there. They were hidden away in this environment. So you were no better off than if you picked up Visual Studio.
I think one of the other arguments that the Java world had against Visual Age Java was that they weren't used to and didn't like to have development that wasn't file-based. Visual Age Java was definitely not a file-based environment. It tried to create file-like things afterwards, but the source wasn't stored in a file-like way.
Yeah, and I think that probably isn't so much to do with the Visual Age line as so much as the choice by the IBM developers when they made the Visual Age for Java, because certainly there's really nothing to stop you using files in these kinds of environments. And I guess the other part of it there was that they were creating, like you said, file-like things at the end of the day from their Envy store.
Well, as I recall, one of the main issues they had with Visual Age Java, maybe this was because Sun was evolving so quickly in the early days, they had difficulty pushing out new versions of VA Java to track accurately the new versions of the Sun JDK that were coming out. So you were always one or two releases behind, is what I seem to recall.
Yeah, I recall that as well.
That's going to be the same for any hot language, I'd say. I mean, if you decided to go and do a Ruby implementation, Ruby 2 is, you know, set to change a whole bunch of stuff. If you were trying to follow Python, each version of Python radically changed language. I remember when I first picked up Python, it was a very procedural-like language, and by the time I got around to actually doing something with Python, it was very OO. And the annoying thing about that was I picked up the OO features and built my program, and by the time I was ready to deploy my program on a server, the various servers that I was ready to deploy on had the older version of Python, so I had to go and rewrite it all in the procedural-like syntax.
One of the interesting things about that, and since you mentioned Ruby, is that I don't have the reference sitting right here in front of me. I could scan around in Bottom Feeder for it. But there was a guy writing today online about how he was having some difficulty trying to get some Ruby code to work across multiple things. I guess if one of you expands on that point, I can hunt around for a second and try to find the reference.
Yeah, I wouldn't know where to begin with that. I'm not sure what that would mean.
I'd given some thought to creating a Ruby compiler that would compile into VisualWorks, like the VisualWorks bytecodes, but I didn't go very far with it. It seems like the Ruby compiler is a rather difficult one to write a compiler for.
Actually,
isn't the syntax for Ruby kind of a bizarre thing?
It is. Actually, this is something we talked about with Avi, the podcast that we lost. There is actually a project to make a Ruby parser in Smalltalk. And this is one of the interesting things about what Avi did, was Avi just called out to the JRuby parser to do all the work for him so that he didn't actually have to implement a parser in Smalltalk itself. And one of the reasons for that was it's so complex to do the parsing. The Ruby parser is... You know how C++ can't be done with LALR and C can barely be done with LALR? Well, Ruby, you can forget it. I think even GLR is really pushing it when it comes to Ruby. So it's a really hand-tooled kind of syntax there. So we were trying to make the Ruby parser in Smalltalk, and I was writing a bunch of tests for it. And the more tests I wrote, the less likely it seemed that the parser was actually ever going to get finished. The syntax was just so bizarre and convoluted. It was turning out to be a really big job for the guy who was doing the parser bit, which his name was Pete. I won't say the rest of his name, but Pete was really struggling with it. So Abby's way of just plugging into an external parser is certainly a good trick. But apparently the parser in JRuby is significantly better written than the actual parser in the C version of Ruby itself.
Was there any part of Ruby that was making it difficult to write that kind of a parser?
Well, all bits of it, really. I mean, the basics of it are pretty simple, but as soon as you get into instance-based messaging, the regular expression stuff mixed in with Ruby calls and all those bits that are just out on the edge there, it starts to become very hairy.
Well, I just found the reference here. Guy who writes a blog under the title Relevance. Let's see, if I go to Feed Properties, maybe I can even tell you who the heck it is. No, of course not. Who knows? I'd have to go and actually hunt down the blog itself, and who knows what that would do to PowerGraml. So what it is here is he just wrote a book, and he sat down yesterday to work through 9 Rails projects, and he said the deprecation stuff, I guess they just deprecated a bunch of stuff, was very easy. Well, let's see. Some plugins depended on eccentricities of code loading. Of my 9 projects, 6 moved to RC1, and the other 3 cannot run on RC1 at all. So he had an entirely difficult time getting things to run on Rails 1.2.
I said, this is RC for Rails or RC for
RC
Ruby?
RC1 of Rails, so it's whatever version of Ruby they're on now, and RC1 of Rails.
Sorry, I didn't think that they had that big of issue. I mean, certainly with Python, the syntax was changing a lot, and the libraries were changing a lot. I didn't realize Ruby was that bad.
Well, I don't know if this is Ruby so much as Rails, so it looks like my earlier theory was about this being Ruby is not entirely correct, because what he's saying here is some plugins, and I guess this is more likely something to do with, let's see, 1.2 RC1 and Kerberos. So it's probably some blogging system that depends on Ruby on Rails and some plugins that based themselves on version X of Ruby on Rails weren't running on the next rev, which is not all that terribly surprising. I've got blog code that needs to be different between VisualWorks 7.1 and VisualWorks 7.4.1.
Yeah, just to note, the name that I have here on that post is by Stuart Holloway.
There you go.
So this really, I guess we go back to the idea of running a different language inside VisualWorks. When it comes down to it, Object Studio, it's a bit of a different story to say, running Ruby in VisualWorks for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, it's the same language, even if it has slightly different execution semantics, it is still Smalltalk. Second of all, it comes with its own toolset, but at the end of the day, since it's still Smalltalk, you can run the regular VisualWorks toolset against it, but it really does come with its own toolset, and that whole toolset can run inside VisualWorks. So, you know, you put that stuff into perspective and then look at the amount of work that went into actually making Object Studio work in VisualWorks under the VisualWorks VM, and it still wasn't a trivial job.
No, actually, it took... They kind of alighted past it in the podcast that they were doing because they were in front of an audience of CENTCOM Smalltalk people, and they didn't want to really let the entire ugly truth come out. But the reality is we had a project back a few years ago now where we were intending to release Object Studio on the VisualWorks VM, and that project actually failed. And part of the reason was that they didn't go full bore into some of the solutions they had to come up with this time. As a matter of fact, it comes up partway through that podcast that one of the things they really had to do was move the event loop up out of the VisualWorks VM and into the Smalltalk image, because otherwise event handling was just too slow. And a lot of that is because the way the VM typically had been doing events is that the VM kind of pre-filtered events and only shoved a select portion of them up to the image. And so if you have a native set of windows and they only get a subset of the events, bad things happen.
So does this mean that Object Studio has a slightly different VM, or did they modify the VM to be compatible with both?
We modified the VM to be compatible with both. So it turns out, and this came out in the podcast, they moved up the event loop from the VM into the image, and there is a platform-specific event handler class or protocol, which I haven't looked in detail. There's a platform-specific event handler for each platform. So there's one for Windows and then one for the other platforms. Well, probably one for Mac, and then the Unix ones are probably all awfully similar. So the thing is that pushing that up meant that they got event handling in a much more performant fashion, and suddenly the thing went from being much, much slower Windows level performance to being pretty much the same as it had been for Object Studio. And that had been a big blocking point in the past for us. But this kind of proves one of your things that you've talked about quite a bit, Michael, that you want to move as many things out of the VM, I think, as is humanly possible.
Oh, yeah. It all comes down to, I guess, the idea of having the simplest system at the lowest level. And that would kind of help with running other systems on top of VisualWorks, but you've still got a lot of other kind of problems in the way. The parse tree syntax that converts into bytecodes that the virtual machine can run is very Smalltalk centric. So if you were going to do a different sort of programming language, generating those bytecodes it's not going to be a trivial task. You could do it, but then all of the other tools that you get inside VisualWorks, your debuggers and inspectors, your class browsers, etc., are going to be pretty much useless to you unless the language you happen to be working with is Smalltalk. So the only advantage you'd be getting out of that would be the faster VM. And it's only faster for the kinds of jobs that you might want to do in a high-level language. So take the Object Studio stuff, for example, where they do lots and lots of C callouts. That's probably the main example there. If your language does a lot of interfacing with other systems, the VisualWorks VM may or may not be optimized well enough for your needs there.
Well, that actually raised an interesting problem they ran across, and that again came up in that podcast they did. The way VisualWorks, or that talk they did at the conference, the way VisualWorks has always worked, it's much faster to send Smalltalk messages than it is to make a call out through DLLCC. It's actually tremendously faster. Whereas over in Object Studio, since they had an interpreter instead of an optimized VM, making C calls was never any real penalty in Object Studio. It was always fairly cheap to make a C call, no more expensive than making a Smalltalk call. So that meant that if you had a slow piece of the system in Smalltalk, it made a lot of sense to throw it down to the VM, which is part of why over in Object Studio, they classically had an awful lot of stuff built into the VM, because over time, lots and lots of stuff ended up getting written in C.
So that dynamic is likely going to be changing with Object Studio 8.
That was one of the main reasons they had to do some of the things they did. Yeah, they pushed a lot of things out of the VM and up into Smalltalk code to be handled in VisualWorks. And even though a lot of their tools are still maintained, they've got their own workspace and they've got their own inspector. And actually, if you look at the Object Studio inspector, it's kind of cool. One of the things, though, they lost, and actually they don't consider it a loss, they have the refactoring browser instead of their browser. And the debugger, they consider our debugger, the VisualWorks debugger, to be a much, much improved tool over what they had, because it had kind of been long in the tooth.
Here's an interesting tidbit for you there about the VisualWorks debugger. I've been training some people in VisualWorks over the last few months, and they come from a Visual Age background, but they come from a Visual Age plus Visual Age Assist background, and they've found that the debugger in VisualWorks is harder. And this is particularly interesting for me, because when I first moved to VisualWorks, which is VisualWorks 7, yes, VisualWorks got this giant upgrade and revamp, and I thought, okay, well, it was kind of weird before, let's give it a go now. And Steve Aldred and I jumped in, and in the first night that we were playing with it, we were able to write a piece of code that downloaded a piece of HTML off the internet, and we could inspect it, and we were very happy. We could see the parallels between Visual Age and VisualWorks, and we could start getting involved in it. But the debugger was sorely lacking when we first moved to VisualWorks. It wasn't the debugger that you can get right now. It didn't have a bunch of features that we used regularly in Visual Age with Visual Age Assist. So I actually got into a close amount of dialogue with Terry Raymond, suggesting all the various different features that we were used to using in Visual Age plus VA Assist that are now available in VisualWorks. And I guess, you know, even at the end of that, now having other people who are used to Visual Age plus Visual Age Assist come and use the VisualWorks debugger, and they're still not entirely comfortable with it. That kind of surprised myself, because I find the VisualWorks debugger to be the best debugger I've ever used now, and certainly the most powerful and advanced, and at the same time, easy enough to use. But their main problem was all the little icons. They can't remember which icon does what, and in reality, when you're using the debugger, the first three plus the resume plus the terminate buttons are pretty much the only ones you ever use. So, and those icons, the step, step into, and step over, are all very similar looking icons. So I guess I can see their point. I'm kind of interested in the kind of debugger that they had in Object Studio before this.
It had a lot of limitations. Basically, there were many, many cases where you just couldn't follow code with it. It was a very, very primitive debugger was the main problem. The interesting thing that comes up about what you just said is Vasily has recognized those issues with the icon set in the old debugger, or I should say the current debugger. If you've been tracking the VW dev builds, I actually was a little thrown by the new icons, because even though I think graphically they make more sense than the 7.4.1 and previous ones, all that muscle memory was lost. So I had to, they're all in the same position, mind you. I guess I shouldn't say muscle memory, but they all look different and they actually make more sense if you stop and look at them.
One feature I like in the new debugger is the step into block feature, which is a real godsend, because trying to trace through the code for do loops or collect loops is a real pain. Being able to push one button and get into the loop really helps out.
And the main part there, Dave, was once you're in the loop, staying there. when we first brought this up with Terry, he put in the feature to allow us to get into that loop just by going boom, step into that loop, and we were like, yay. And then when we get to the end of the loop, and no matter what button we pressed, we couldn't get back to the start of the loop to do the next iteration. We would always end up back in the iteration code itself or leave the block. So we exulted with much glee when suddenly we could stay in the iteration instead of going into the inner workings of the iteration.
Yes, and I found that worked nicely, but you have to be careful at all times which button you push. Because if you do push the wrong one, you do jump out of the loop.
Yeah, especially you need to be careful if you happen to be debugging with style code when that happens, because you can end up in some pretty twisty places.
There's some very magical stuff going on there.
Yeah, to say the least. Going back to the whole idea of modeling a system then, so you'd say, Michael, that trying to model something like another language entirely, a Ruby or a Python or what have you, in Smalltalk, would probably not give you the benefits that a lot of people seem to think it would. Although, interestingly enough, if you jump far enough in the Wayback Machine, and Dave probably remembers this, there was an ObjectWorks C++ way, way, way back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Did you ever work with that?
I've never really worked with it. I stayed on the Smalltalk site, but I do remember there was a C++.
Yeah, it was actually going out of production just as I came into the sales group at Park Place back in the day. And the interesting thing was they had difficulty selling it, not because it wasn't file-based. It was certainly using it was based on the whole idea of loading and compiling files. But it had some interesting things to it. You could actually write C++ in a workspace and then highlight it and do it or inspect it, just like you could in Smalltalk. And
nice.
But yeah, it was very nice. I remember hearing from some of the developers that when they demoed that, it kind of threw C++ developers for a loop. They didn't quite know what to do with it.
I'd say, just to go back to your question there about is it worthwhile, I'd say you could definitely pick up a huge speed gain by picking up the VM, without a doubt. And you could certainly pick up a whole bunch of libraries to reuse in your, say, let's just pick on Ruby. Ruby would now be able to use, say, OpenTalk and all those sorts of things, which would be very interesting and very powerful, although the similar sorts of libraries already exist in the Ruby world. But you would be looking at basically making a new product. You couldn't say it was Visual Works running Ruby. You would have to target it as a new product, which would bring along all the regular whole marketing issues and support issues, etc. It's a whole new venture for anybody who's going into that. I mean, it is a whole new product. And then you've got the bigger problem, which is really the reason why Java succeeded in the first place, is that you have an environment that requires some sort of lock-in. If you get people using Ruby inside the Visual Works Ruby, and the only real advantages they're getting apart from speed are these other libraries, and people start using these other libraries, they can't do that in any other Ruby environment. They have to use your Ruby environment to do that, so people won't. To put it simply, they won't do that. They'll avoid those libraries and just keep using the libraries that you can use in any Ruby, because they want an open environment. That's one of the main reasons that Ruby exists, and in fact it's the next step on from Java, is because it's more open than Java.
Well, actually, even within Smalltalk, I can give you a simple example of that right within our own product, and that is that back before CINCOM took over the product, ObjectShare, and before it, Park Place Digitalk, had been selling the core system and then everything else, distributed Smalltalk, Visual Wave, the C programming object kit, everything. Everything else was an add-on. The only two that people used with any kind of regularity were the C programming object kit and the advanced tools, which is more or less just the profiler. There used to be a thing called the advanced browser in there, which is now sort of the backwards browser.
Yeah, I found that the other day.
Yeah, and it's having it called the advanced browser is kind of an interesting thing all by itself. But the interesting thing is those are the only two components that were typically used, and that's because the C kit was absolutely essential, and the profiler was absolutely essential, but also Park Place sold them for a price that was pretty trivial. Now, when they added distributed Smalltalk and they added Visual Wave, what happened was they were trying to sell those for real prices, and I tried to tell people, look, there's a whole lot of value here, so you got to pay us some valuable money. And we had customers going off and building their own kinds of tool sets, not necessarily their own Corba tool sets, but they'd either buy the Corba tool set from a competitor, there was a competing product out there, or in the case of Visual Wave, they would roll their own tool sets. So even within Smalltalk, when it wasn't all bundled, they would use their own stuff. One of the primary reasons we started bundling everything was kind of out of self-defense. We wanted people to be using all of our stuff so that there was a rationale for us to keep maintaining it, and also so that it would keep getting exercised. If we weren't shipping it all in one box, there was most of it just wouldn't get used.
But that's a very interesting point there, James. If you look at many different environments, they'll provide you this IDE and maybe the language, etc., but they weren't really... take Java. Java's a good example. They're not going to provide you with a ginormous feature set of different libraries that perform, you know, miracle this and miracle that. Java focused in on the areas that was going to win at markets, such as their web technology. But anything beyond that, they just didn't make. In a way, CINCOM has got a much more difficult task here than most other vendors. They are doing half of what Microsoft has to do when it comes to providing libraries, and then they're also providing language, and then also providing IDEs. And with a handful of people, as opposed to, that's obviously the advantage of Smalltalk, is that you can do these amazing things with very few people, but such a huge job here.
Well, yeah, that's one of our large problems, is trying to figure out what we can't, what we should and shouldn't do. The other difficulty you get into, though, as a smaller provider, is that if your market segment isn't big enough, the difficulty you get into is that maybe you'd say, ideally speaking, CINCOM shouldn't be providing Component X. Component X should be being written by a third party. Well, the reality is, if your market segment isn't big enough, then third parties really can't enter into it, because in order for them to sell a product at anything that vaguely resembles a profit, they have to mark it up so much that very few people actually buy it. It's kind of an interesting problem.
There are a number of products that went that way. One that I can't think of is the what used to be called the PDP Debugger by Terry Raymond. That was eventually just merged straight into the Visual Works system. But Terry had a number of applications like that you could buy separately. And I guess he just had a hard time getting people to buy them.
Yeah, well, the problem is you either set it at a low price so that lots of people will buy it, but since the segment itself is not that tremendously large, unless almost all of them buy it, you just don't make enough money to eat. And then you get into the other problem. If you set the price too high, you have to have the right magic number buy it, or else you still don't eat. So yeah, it's a very difficult place for third parties to make money unless the market segment is very, very large. And actually, I ran numbers on this quite a while ago. You know, CINCOM's current pricing model is a subscription thing. And I've had, over the years, I've periodically had people ask me, well, why don't you just sell the tool set for a couple thousand bucks per developer seat? And I think I explained this out in a blog post once. I went out and ran numbers where I said, you know, the difficulty is that with the current engineering team size we have, it was getting into the tens of thousands of seats we'd have to sell at that price every single year just in order to break even. And I don't know that that's sustainable. I don't know how starting from scratch, how do you sell that many seats and then keep doing it every year?
And you'll see the same thing in the Ruby and Python community too, is that it's simply not something that they even try. All the various libraries like the Ruby on Rails or the Corbel lookalike or the OpenTorp lookalike, etc., they're all open source things. No one's even trying to sell anything there at this point because the crowd's just not big enough. And ironically, even if you look at the Visual Basic world, people sell components in the Visual Basic world for $10 or $100, and even in that space, people rarely actually buy those things.
Well, that actually came up in last week's conversation with Peter Fisk, if you recall. He was talking about selling add-on SDKs for, what was it, like $29?
That's right.
And that means that he's obviously not really planning on making money from those tools directly. He's planning on making money one of two ways. Either he's expecting to get bought, or he's expecting to make consulting dollars.
Or he's expecting to build interesting things on top of the platform to sell.
Right. Other product, or yeah, that's the other thing. That's actually what the Smalltalk X guys do, accept software out of Germany.
And Dolphin,
They don't really expect to make money on Smalltalk X per se. They expect to go in and have Smalltalk X in their bag and say, look, we can deliver a project so much faster than the other guys because we've got these cool tools in our pocket.
Yeah.
Getting back for a sec to the Visual Works pricing model, if you did charge a per-seat charge for the developers, what you'd find is that it would be a big disincentive for people to upgrade, because now they'd have to buy 20 new versions of the system at a certain price. And a lot of companies would say, no, we'll just stick with the old version and not upgrade at all. And if you think you have a problem now with people staying on 2.5, you'd have even more if you didn't have a subscription model.
Well, I find, I actually find that subscription model pretty fair. If you manage to make a million bucks, you made $1 million, then you're essentially paying on your wages one extra developer, a cheap developer at that, who contributed more than any of your other developers contributed to your project. He contributed a virtual machine, a development environment, a whole bunch of libraries, etc. So that one particular salary you're paying there out of your profits for your $1 million, he was well worth it.
I guess the hard part of it for people is to understand what price they're going to be paying and what to expect. Like, if you have a project that has one Smalltalk component and then a C++ component and a Java component, and they all form together to make the product, then what do you arrange as the price of the Smalltalk part?
Yeah.
It's not like your full revenue comes from just the Smalltalk. And it's unfair to say that, you know, you'll take a percentage of the revenues or profits or whatever it might be without sort of first negotiating it with Syncom. And that's the hard part. People don't want to sit down and negotiate it.
That's very true, Dave.
It makes life a little difficult. I mean, it's a rock and a hard place kind of question. We actually, with our existing customer base, we've got a fairly decent set of understanding now, pretty much what Michael just explained, whereby they do want us to stay in business, and they're willing to pay us money to keep us in business. But with new customers, and it's not that we don't get them, we do. We actually have a growing revenue base and a growing customer base. But one of the difficulties of landing new customers is that they point to things like Ruby, and they point to things like Java, and they even point to the Microsoft stuff, which you can get in on the low end pretty cheaply. Now, as you move up the scale, they charge real money, but nobody looks at the up the scale stuff. They look at the stuff they find first on the web page. And, you know, Syncom Smalltalk looks more expensive to them out the starting gate.
And it's hard for them to tell how expensive it is because the prices are never actually listed.
Yeah, that's a corporate policy that I don't really have a whole lot of impact over. I've gone to the well on that one more than once with my management, and the reality is that's the way Syncom operates, and it's one of the things I've had to just deal with as a reality and just decided to let slip and move on because I'm not going to change that anytime soon.
But this is part of a growing trend that I see in the software industry, that basically people don't value software. People would much rather go get some sort of free product and use that and not consider paying money for any sort of software product. I was listening to one computer radio show today, and they were lamenting the fact that one of the virus checkers, has now changed from a freeware product to a commercial product costing $29 or something. And they were saying, well, let's see if we can find some other free ones that you can still use. And I'm thinking $29 is not that bad for an antivirus program. But just the mentality that I'm not going to keep paying software or paying for every little piece of software that I have on my system.
Yeah, it's actually a more of a matter of convenience. It's a real pain in the butt to actually purchase software. And exactly what it is you're purchasing is often very muddy for most companies. I just bought a Wii, and I've got my Nintendo Wii set up in the lounge room, and included in the Wii is the Wii Shop. And it makes it extremely obvious and simple to purchase things. And I bet my bottom dollar they make a fair bit of money off the Wii Shop. I believe the PlayStation 3 is going to have something similar, or has something similar. iTunes makes it extremely simple for people to purchase things. But when it comes to actually buying software, you've got to kind of look at Microsoft and say, hey, Microsoft, where's the purchase software facility in your operating system for people to list their program and have it be bought?
Well, that traces back, oh, many, many years now. And actually, the recording industry is trying desperately to do the same thing. They've got the weight of inertia weighing down on them to make it harder, but they're trying. And that is that I'd have to look, I guess, in a more detailed way, but sometime after the IBM era, actually, oddly enough, Syncom was one of the pioneers in this area, software stopped being something you purchased outright and started being licensed. And, of course, the music industry is attempting to do the same thing with music, but I kind of think the cat's mostly out of the bag on that one. But with software, that's just the way it's been for a long, long time now, is that if you look carefully at the license agreements you sign for any software you pick up, it's very rare that you actually technically own the thing you purchased. You've licensed some kind of usage arrangement.
Yeah, I can't remember any software lately that has an agreement other than a licensing agreement.
That's okay. I'm more interested in the convenience, giving people the ability to just go, you know, $30, that's pretty reasonable, tick. Instead, they'll go, well, I was using this program, and now the program tells me I can't use it unless I go to this website, give my credit card details, go through this remembering wall. You know, I was kind of happy with the way it was, and now it's a pain in the butt. If instead it popped up and said, you know, this program, you can't use it anymore unless you click this one button here, and everything else you need to do is just taken care of you because you've set up your operating system to be able to do this, you'd get a lot of people just going, yep, I'm done, I'll have that.
Well, the other thing is, on a modern computer system, you have typically thousands of programs that are on your system or at your disposal. And if you think that you're going to start paying money for each of those thousand programs, you're going to go broke pretty quick.
Well, I think what Michael is getting at is not so much that you want to pay money for each one of them, but somehow make a standard or something that vaguely resembles standard, at least from the user's perspective, way to purchase upgrades or new versions of software. I mean, I've got bunches and bunches of software that wants to be able to auto-update itself. I mean, iTunes does it, for instance, and Windows, in theory, does it, although oftentimes I really would rather it didn't. But various software knows how to update itself. And I think what Michael's asking for is just a way to have that update go one additional step. And if it's software that costs money, make it just as easy to purchase as it is to get the update for something like iTunes.
Yeah, and if some piece of software keeps asking you for money over and over again, that's when you're going to lose the business. And that's the way it should be if you're pestering your customer saying, well, you've drunk half that cup of coffee, maybe you want to give us a bit more money to finish drinking the rest of the coffee, or we'll just take the cup off you. You know, so that's that kind of model obviously is going to fail, unless it's, you know, something in the background that says every year, insert $50 into this other account. And that's the kind of facility that should be in Windows. But we won't see it anytime soon for one reason and one reason only. For a long while now, Microsoft has had this idea that they are the platform and they are not a facilitator, even though they facilitate. And as a result of that policy, Microsoft looks at what's successful and either buys it or copies it. They're not interested in being a platform that allows people to sell at the same level that they are at. They don't want people to be able to compete with them. They want people to compete with each other, and they can swoop in and make the low-cost alternative later.
There's one other thing in that, too, and I think that there's also a legal angle that falls into this, too. Since Microsoft's been hip for anti-competitive behavior, I rather suspect that their lawyers would be leery about putting any kind of facilitation thing like that that even looked like it was funneling all those transactions through Microsoft. Whether they were funneling them through Microsoft, whether they even made money off it, is less of an issue, really, than whether they thought the various watchdog agencies and other companies would paint it that way.
Yeah, exactly.
I think a lot of their actions right now are colored the same way that IBM's were back in the early 90s and late 80s, when they were still shuddering from all the antitrust regulation that had been thrown their way. Microsoft's in the same place right now.
Yeah, and if you look at the PlayStation 3, which may or may not succeed over time, they're trying to do exactly what I'm talking about. They're putting a machine in everybody's lounge room that is something that they'll use on a daily basis. It includes phone and video phone, games, multimedia, music, video, all those sorts of things. But integrated into that mess is one or two touch purchasing.
Okay. Well, you know what? We've been plowing forward for a little over 40 minutes now, so I think we've probably beaten this to death.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Well, not only that, David and I are probably thinking it's 1 a.m. When does this end?
Yeah, it's getting pretty late here.
Well, it's 36 degrees here. It's bloody hot.
Yeah, meanwhile, it's under 20 here, and God knows what it is where David is.
Well, I'm in 36 Celsius.
Yeah, here we use Celsius as well, and we're probably about -5 or so.
Oh,
okay. Wow.
Not too bad. Cool. wait until January when we get the -35s.
No, I think I'll stay in Maryland, thanks. So, all right.
Okay, very good, James.
See you guys.
See you later, Michael.
Bye.
Stay tuned for this week's Small Talk Jobs Report with James Savage.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Small Talk Jobs Report. North America. Syncom is looking for a business development manager for their Smalltalk division. They are looking for a wide range of experience beyond knowledge of Smalltalk. You must be willing to travel, have experience in presenting the Smalltalk message, can research target markets and new industries to target, can develop business case for overall product line and support in same for partner organizations, be willing to assist sales support organizations, can develop metrics for quantification of sales leads, qualification, be willing to work closely with team to continually develop the message and UVP, willing to build up current partners and customer opportunities, and you should have experience as a business development manager. Sydney, Australia. Vantage Recruitment is looking for a junior Smalltalk developer with experience with Microsoft Windows, OOAD, and relational databases. Brandenburg, Germany. West LB is looking for an IT specialist with experience with Smalltalk, C, C++, Java, financial derivatives interest or experience, English language, mathematics background, and SQL. Please note, even with translation help from Google and my wife, it is unclear if these positions will actually involve Smalltalk programming. Stuttgart, Germany. Klein Stegel AG has multiple software Entwickler positions available. They are looking for people with experience with PL1, Delphi, Visual Basic, Smalltalk, C, C++, Java, mainframe experience, Unix, and Microsoft Windows. Arlington, Virginia. The Philadelphia Backlog Elimination Recruitment Center has a position for an applications computer software engineer with experience with Smalltalk, OOAD, and Oracle. Boston, Massachusetts. Global Consultants is looking for a Smalltalk developer with additional experience with Unix, Oracle, SQL, relational databases, AIX, and Solaris. This is a one-year contract and pays $60 to $70 an hour. Fort Worth, Texas. SCB Computer Technology, Inc. is looking for a senior Smalltalk programmer with additional experience with C++, Java, MFC, and macOS. These are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
And that's a wrap on Episode 13 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson, Michael Lucas Smith, and David Bach. Over the course of the next week, I'll be getting more of the podcast audio from the CINCOM Smalltalk Users Conference up on the site. I've got the first four of them up there now, and more of them should be appearing all week long. Hope you enjoy those, hope you enjoyed this podcast, and I'll see you next week.
Darling, I gotta talk to you about the things you've been putting me through now. I gotta talk to you, I gotta be in.